What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast AT Consultant Business. I've got Adam Halpert. He was on yesterday with Innovate AT, and he connected me with both Dr. Jeff Conan and Dr. Mickey Cuppett, and they are experts in athletic training. If you ask them, they'll tell you. They'll just say, like, hey, look at my bio. I know what I'm talking about. And so they have actually a lot of experience and have done a lot of different things. And really, if there's anything you need to know, they can probably point you in the right direction. So I'm actually going to have Jeff introduce Mickey and Mickey introduce Jeff because they're good friends. And I just want to see how well they actually know each other. But we're talking about AT Consultant because both of them do consulting for athletic training. And I want to see how, you know, you can set yourself up to be in that position as an athletic trainer, as an expert in one field, whether it's with ATIP programs or with athletic training businesses, kind of like Adam is doing and kind of putting himself in that role as an AT consultant for businesses. So this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/consultant. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/consultant, where again, I'll have all the ways to contact each of the people on here. Without much further ado, Dr. Jeff Conan, why don't you introduce your friend, Dr. Mickey Cuppett?
Absolutely. Good morning. And first of all, thanks for having us. I'm excited to be a part of this program today. One of the nice things about being a consultant is you get to travel around and learn how different people do different things. So this is actually a first for me to introduce somebody else without seeing their bio. So Mickey Cuppett is a good friend of mine. Mickey lives right over the water here. I could probably throw a rock to our house, ironically. And we first started working together in 2006 at the University of South Florida. Mickey has an amazing background, both as a faculty member and academician. She's also had some dabbles in forms of technology and simulation. And of course, many of us know her as the executive director of Katie for many years, leading lots of new initiatives. And Mickey never stops working and creating new ideas and helping others succeed. And earlier we were just talking about now one of her additional initiatives in working with ACES and to help students pass the BOC exam. So actually, I'm really excited to be a part of this program collaboratively with Mickey and also, of course, with Adam.
Hey, that's a fantastic job. I think you covered everything she wanted me to cover. All right, Dr. Cuppett.
All right. Well, thank you, Jeff, for the wonderful introduction. And Jeremy and Adam, thanks for asking me to be on the podcast. And I was really excited to be on here and especially excited when you said that Jeff would be on here as well. So, you know, as Jeff said, we've known each other for a long time, since about 2006 at University of South Florida. And our paths keep crossing back and forth, and we've held different positions. Jeff decided that he wanted to leave athletic training for a while and try his hand at athletics administration. So he went back to his alma mater and was athletic director for a while. But at the University of South Florida, there were a lot of times that Jeff and I got together and solved a lot of problems with usually a bottle of red wine and a napkin, and there wasn't much that we couldn't solve. Jeff is one of the most entrepreneurial people that I've ever met, and he's got a lot of great ideas. He's served in a lot of different capacities, both as an athletic trainer, physical therapist, has known internationally, and just really happy on this the show with him. We continue to collaborate. As Jeff said, we're not very far away. I think it's about a 9-iron from my place to Jeff's, and we tend to talk on the phone a lot, but even though we're so close, we have to go out of town to see each other, I think, a lot of times. So anyway, happy to be on here, and hopefully we can answer some questions.
All right, that is fantastic. Both of them, like I said, internationally known, lots of books, lots of knowledge, lots of experiences. When I first talked with Dr. Jeff Conan about being on this podcast, he called me, and I think we talked for like 45 minutes just about the stuff he's done and the opportunities that I have with the podcast. So very knowledgeable, very willing to help. And so at the end, they'll tell you how to get a hold of them. I think both of them have basically is theirname.com. As their website, but we'll go over that at the end. So, of course, Adam from Innovate AT. Adam, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. 24 hours later, good to see you again.
And then, so we're talking about consulting as an athletic trainer, but let's kind of define what that looks like for you guys. We'll start with you, Dr. Mickey Cuppett. What does that look like being an AT consultant?
Well, I'm actually a full-time consultant. So this is my job right now. And I've actually been an LLC for about a year. Really, I incorporated at the 1st of January, 2019. And so this is what I do full time. And so my areas of expertise are accreditation, athletic training curricula, athletic training programs, and so forth, assessment. So I've got several programs that have contacted me, and I'm working with several programs simultaneously on developing curriculum, especially now as many programs are transitioning to the master's degree. They need some help, and I really enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun, and just being able to see programs succeed and being able to help them succeed with their athletic training programs.
All right, and Dr. Conan, what does AT consulting look like for you?
Well, you know, that's a loaded question for me. Over the last couple of decades, I've dabbled in a number of different areas. I think the majority of time that I've spent has been in the area we call risk management. Some would call it legal consulting, but obviously I'm not a lawyer. But what we do is help individuals, programs, clinics, identify ways to minimize their risk and exposure to litigation. And so I was very fortunate enough years ago to partner with Rob Braeberg, another outstanding individual in our profession, and we created a legal consulting firm. We work with attorneys, we work with universities. But along the ways, what I found is that I guess to be a consultant, you have to have some knowledge or experience. And sometimes it doesn't have to be an athletic training. Business knowledge, computer technology knowledge, something along the lines to help ATs in their job improve. And if you step off an airplane, you're automatically considered a long-distance expert in some cases, even though some of your experts live in your own backyard. But what I realized was that as you travel from one place to the other, sometimes that's a disadvantage. And other times it's actually an advantage because you get to learn a whole lot more from a lot of different people in a number of different organizations. And you can share that knowledge with others as a consultant. And honestly, Jeremy, as much as I do consulting for a fee, I also do quite a bit for gratis with many friends. And that's done just through telephone calls and emails and even personal visits where we can help each other out. Because at the end of the day, I mean, the additional money as a consultant is always nice. And in Mickey's case, it's probably not just nice, but if it's your full-time job, it's necessary. But the reality is networking is what leads to consulting, and that's where your opportunities come about. And I think Adam can speak to this because that's exactly how he and I met at our annual meeting. And we just said, hey, let's get together and have a drink and talk about what do each other do and how can we help each other out.
All right. So both of you actually mentioned working with ATIP programs or universities or clinics. So here I am in the secondary setting, and you know, a large part of the audience that I kind of lean towards is athletic trainers in the secondary setting. So how much consulting is done for athletic trainers in the secondary setting? And Adam, you can jump in on this too as you feel needed. Anybody?
Well, as far as you know, curriculum and accreditation and so forth, there really isn't an opportunity or probably isn't a need for the secondary schools to hire a consultant at this point. But I would think as far as things like risk management, maybe value, showing value for the athletic trainer, those kinds of things, that those possibilities certainly are there. And maybe Jeff can expand on that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think the answer to your question is not enough. And unfortunately, money is used as the excuse. And the individuals in those settings who benefit from consulting, again, it's done peer-to-peer type consulting due to friendships and relationships. Maybe it's on a district type basis where the schools within a conference will get together and collaborate and talk about best practices. But I actually think it's a shame within the profession that the settings that we practice in tend to define the standard of care. And that's where the risk management consulting type comes in, because each individual should get the same level of care as what the gold standards are. But unfortunately, the resources are what limits those opportunities. And you all probably know better than I do, but I think the data still shows that a majority, a number of our new grads take positions as their first jobs in a secondary school setting. And from a risk management standpoint, I think that's the riskiest position you can possibly be in with the least amount of experience. Look at your ratios, right? It's you and how many student athletes. And that's packaged into a window of time where you're expected to manage all those same individuals at once. That not only limits your ability to provide professional care to all of them equally, it limits the adequacy of proper and strong documentation to support you, whether it's to protect yourself against liability, or what we're reading and hearing a lot about now is to show your value. It's a lot more difficult to document your value if you're treating people in a short window of time there. I think the other aspect is that you tend to lose true hands-on rehabilitation. And sometimes those individuals are farmed out because you just don't have the ability to do the rehab that you'd like to do. And obviously the list of support staff, whether it's administrative assistant, other assistants to work with you. I don't think it's necessary the bells and whistles of a larger facility or more equipment. I think human resources are your best resources and time. And those are two things that are lacking in those settings. To add one more complicated piece, I believe each of those individuals has their own team physician, so to say. So you're not collaborating with the single person who you work in collaboration or direction under. You're having to figure out how to work with each of those individuals, hundreds of different physicians to provide care for those individuals.
Yeah, Jeremy, I'll give a couple comments. What we found is what's difficult for the secondary school setting is just the workload that they have, and truly understanding how they need to be number one. So what we're focusing on is the individual growth, that sometimes if we look at all the just the CEU opportunities that are out there and going to conferences, a lot of it is clinical based because we want to be the best clinician that we can be. But we see a lack of growth within the person. So what we're focusing on is how do we focus on crucial conversations, understanding your passion, how does that lead to becoming a better professional in the field? So I think the lack of personal development and growth at the secondary schools, because they are so isolated, like Jeff and Mickey just talked about, that's one thing that needs to be addressed at the secondary schools is how does the individual grow, which will then in turn make the whole profession grow at the same time.
And I think I'd just like to add a little bit to what both of Adam and Jeff have said, that at the secondary school level, you may be the only healthcare provider these kids see. At the collegiate level, there's a big support staff, and there's all kinds of medical professionals around. But especially if you're in an inner city school, there's all of these other environmental conditions that you might be dealing with as an athletic trainer. You might be the only healthcare provider that these students ever get to see. And so therefore, you really have to try to manage that. They may not have insurance. There's a lot of things that make it difficult just because of the environment that the secondary school athletic trainer is in.
And Jeremy, two points I'd like to add, piggybacking what you just heard, particularly from Adam's perspective and what he's doing, which is really, really great work he and Brandy and others are doing on individual growth. Because when you are the only person in that environment, you don't have the ability to manage or supervise others and learn about that process. You don't have the ability to learn from a mentor in the same discipline in that same process. There's nothing wrong with having a supervisor who might be an AD or a principal, as long as they understand what they're evaluating you on with you. I think this is an inherent problem within our profession. I don't have the solution for it, and I don't understand why this happens. But for some reason, if you're in a collegiate setting as an athletic trainer and you want to transition jobs, if you go apply to a secondary school job, you may be competitive in that pool. But the flip side is you may not be as competitive, if you're leaving a secondary school setting and applying for an intercollegiate job. And this is my personal opinion. I have no data and objectivity to support this, but anecdotally talking to people, this is what we tend to see across the board. And if you want to expand it to another level, if you take a person from a secondary school and they apply for a job in a professional setting, they may not get a good look and a fair look. But if you take an individual who's leaving a professional setting and they apply for a secondary school setting job, for some reason, everyone might look at that and say, wow, we're going to take this person who used to work with a professional team, and now they're going to come and work at our high school. And I don't think that's necessarily fair because the skill sets are completely different, but I think it is an inherent disadvantage of career growth for individuals in secondary schools. Now, with that said, there's nothing wrong with having a full-time, lifelong career in a secondary school. I'm envious of those that have done that and done it well and successfully and are going to retire and enjoy their life. But I think it is something that I hear and see over the last, you know, decades of talking to people.
And to that point, I actually talked with an athletic trainer that used to work at the collegiate setting. Then he worked in pro sports. Now he's in a hospital setting, and he was looking at going back to the collegiate setting. And because he hadn't been in the collegiate setting for a couple of years, they felt he was unqualified to work in the collegiate setting. He's like, I've been working with hospital administrators for 5 years. I think I can handle a coach's personality. But it's just interesting how sometimes our profession gets so segmented based on the setting instead of the skill set that it's limiting our growth, you know, in other professions, because we're just so segmenting ourselves out and we're just isolating ourselves within wherever they work. Very interesting.
And it's going to continue to do that because we've created committees within the organization that are subset by our settings. And I understand the reason why, and I fully support that. But so long as that continues, we might still have this challenge of career growth or transitions within individuals.
All right. So we're talking about consultant, and I think this is fantastic that we're, again, focusing on secondary, because like I said, this is where I am, and some of the things that we can work to changing. So you both of y'all, do not or have not worked in the secondary setting for a majority of your career. So if you are going to tell me how to move towards becoming an AT consultant towards the end of my career, once I have that expertise, what would you recommend? Earlier you said network marketing, and Dr. Conan, that's how you and Adam kind of got hooked up, was just, you saw each other at a meeting, you kind of had a similar mindset, you sat down and had a drink and had some conversations. So coach me towards becoming an AT consultant.
Yeah. So for thought, to clear the record, I think Adam had 2 drinks that night, if I'm not mistaken. You have an expertise from your own daily experience, day after day, year after year, setting after setting. And what you need to do is a self-evaluation, and you would sit down and say, okay, what are my strengths? Where have I spent my time? What can I offer to others in similar settings or to lesser experienced athletic trainers, and put that package together? Everybody has a value. And it's not only from what you've done right. You can learn from the things that didn't go so well, which qualify you equally as much, quite frankly, as a consultant. Because sharing information with individuals about what not to do to make the same mistakes sometimes is even more valuable. And believe me, we've all made plenty of mistakes, particularly earlier in our career. And that's why they call experience. And so if it is your goal to consult professionally, then you want to package that information from a marketing standpoint and sell it to people and get your name out there as a person who does that. Because when we have our conferences, whether they're state, district, or national, essentially networking is consulting. That's what we're all doing with each other, sharing our daily grind. What's worked for you? What will you do with these new changes that are coming down the pike? That's exactly what networking and consulting is all about. And I love the opportunity when I can sit down and meet with people I've never met before, and I learn from them. Just because I don't know them doesn't mean they don't have something to offer. And so as you do this, you meet more and more and more people, expand your network and expand your ability, not only become a consultant, but to learn more for your own consulting purposes.
Yeah, I would just add on to that that one of the things mistakes that a lot of people make when they first enter into consulting is that they try to cast too broad of a net. And you know, you have to really do the self-evaluation and figure out what it is that you're an expert at and focus on those areas. And you know, sometimes trying to cast too much of a broad net will actually make it look like you're not as qualified in a certain area. So you almost have to have a little niche and be known for that niche and then market that and brand that. And so for both Jeff and I, our brands were actually our names because people knew us, we've been around for long enough. And so that's why both of us have just used our names in our consulting businesses as opposed to trying to come up with some fancy name that nobody knows, because then you would have to educate them on who it is. So I think those are a couple of things that those people that are interested in consulting, you know, figure out what it is that you're really good at, you know, get good at it before you decide to give up your job and go into consulting full time, because you might not be able to make, put food on the table otherwise. And if you're being requested for those kind of things while you still are employed, then it's fairly easy to go off and start your own consulting business.
Yeah, I agree with everything they're saying. To all the listeners that know me, I don't drink. So I think Jeff thinks he might have had too many that started, but hearing both Mickey and Jeff talk, there's a correlation between consulting and mentoring, that expertise and wisdom and experience can lead to someone wanting that valuable information. Unfortunately, our profession is notorious to not wanting to pay for information. We feel we don't make enough money. We feel someone else should pay for it. And I think in order for our profession to really grow and for the term consulting/mentoring to be successful, the individual athletic trainer needs to invest in themselves to look at a Mickey and look at a Jeff and say, you know what, they're going to help me get where I want to go, and I'm going to invest in myself and paying for that consulting. But there's too many athletic trainers across the country that give away all their expertise. And I'm not saying for free, but they don't value themselves to then have the trickle-down effect that the newer generations realize they should be paying for that expertise. So the big advice I have, Jeremy, is if someone in the secondary school setting wants to have a secondary income, or if they realize that they have some knowledge that other people don't have, they have to stick to their guns and say, you know what, this is valuable. I've spent 30 years getting to this point. I value myself and people should pay for it. And that's not going against what Jeff said, that everybody should, or you shouldn't do stuff for free, because that's part of the networking and that's part of the relationship we have across the profession. But if we talk about the whole value model and we don't charge for that expertise, then we're our own demise. And that's the biggest thing within our profession is value right now. But we're chopping off our own legs. I mean, we all know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And I want to add one more thing, Jeremy, because so far in these last 20 minutes, the three of us have agreed with each other and everything we said. But I think also part of going out and learning consulting is being courageous and brave and not necessarily agreeing with people all the time. So standing behind what you believe in that can work. If you're hired as a consultant and you come in and you just tell people what they want to hear, and say, oh, you're doing everything right, you're really doing them a disservice. And, Mickey and I worked together for many, many years, and I can promise you we had our share of disagreements. And go ahead, you can laugh, Mickey. but part of it is to put everything on the table and look at all of the circumstances that can be possible. So when you come in as a consultant, you might have experience and knowledge. And what your job is not to tell someone else how to do something better, but to show them the way to critically think, to figure out, here are all the other ways you can do what you're doing. And then you figure out which is the best in that environment. It's really important to understand as a consultant, you're offering advice in a small, small window or snapshot of time. That other person lives in that environment, or that organization lives in that organization. So you're gathering as much information as you can in a short period of time and offering advice, not necessarily tell them how they should do things. Now, there might be situations in my line of risk management where there could be some real black and white issues. You have to change this because this is being done illegally. But in many other cases, it's offering suggestions to solutions that you can do things in a better, more efficient way at your daily job.
All right. So you were talking about just a snapshot. So here I am. I'm in the secondary setting. So say, I continue to do the podcast. I continue to mentor the new athletic trainer that we're going to hire. I continue to reach out. And, you know, I say Jeremy Jackson and the Sports Medicine Broadcast are known for innovating in athletic training in the secondary setting. And so now I want to, begin helping other programs improve and grow. What would you say to me specifically? Like, how do I avoid just that snapshot, or how do I maximize that snapshot? So do I go over there for one day, or, you know, go one day for 3 weeks and that kind of thing? So just kind of, obviously we're kind of, it's all hypothetical here, but what do you think that would look like for me?
Well, I think it's really about the relationship between you and whomever the client is, and what they need from you, and what they what they want. It might be, in some situations, it might be fine to do things totally virtual. If it's just a review of documents, let's say someone wants you to look at their policy and procedure manual, well, you might be able to just do that via distance. But if they want you to come in, it depends on how many people that you need to talk with, whether it's a day, whether it's 2 days that you're going to be on campus again or on site. But it's really about what the client wants you to do and what they're willing to pay you for. You might have a whole bunch of different ideas, but if the client doesn't want you to explore those areas, they may only want you to look at a couple of things. Well, then that's what you end up doing. And you negotiate that in a contract ahead of time so that both parties know exactly what the scope of work is.
Yeah, Jeremy, a way to look at it is you want to provide what the client needs instead of what you think they want. So you have to ask them, like, what are you looking to accomplish? What are some of your setbacks? What do you think you can improve? And then you might have the solution instead of going to them and saying, I can do this, I can do that. You want me to do this for you? Because that might just be overwhelming, because they might be looking at EAPs in the meantime, and you're trying to sell them how to cover 10 sports at once. So it might not be talking the same language. So just having a better discovery with the potential high schools about what some of their limitations are, then you might have a solution for their pain points. And then within your area, you might become that resident expert about one thing. And that goes to Mickey's point that you have a niche service that everyone wants. And then that's easier to sell because you start to gain testimonials, you gain credibility, and then you can kind of scale it from there.
Yeah, so I was waiting to see how long we went before we throw the word credibility out. I think that's really the key, because you hear people say all the time in all professions that it's who you know. And I think there's some truth to that, but I think it's also what you do for who you know. Because if you're out there selling your services as a consultant and the people receiving the product are not impressed with what you've given them, it doesn't help you know them. In fact, it will backfire. But to what Adam just said, when you build up the credibility, you now have individuals who can endorse you, and that will take care of itself in terms of your consulting. So one of the questions we haven't addressed yet is, how do you put yourself out there? How do you market yourself? You know, in this day and age now, we have a lot of social media and we use websites and other things. But prior to that, it was word of mouth, quite frankly. And word of mouth is what credibility is all about. You all know as well as I do, you can follow social media, and there's a whole lot of self-proclaimed social media gurus. You follow them long enough, you can see right through the fluff and realize that they're really good at social media, but they don't have an expert niche to speak behind and stand behind. And so I think the credibility piece is enormous. And so whatever your niche is, and this is where sometimes when you're first starting, Jeremy, You have to be a little flexible in what you think your value is, because you want to build up a client base. You also might find yourself in a circumstance, unfortunately, going to what Adam said, in certain settings that you work with, they have a limited budget. And they'll say, you know, this is what I can pay you. Will you do it for this? And you kind of have to decide if you're willing to do that or not. If you're first starting out, it might not be a bad thing to do to give yourself some practice consulting and to build up your credibility with client base. After a while, you get busy enough, and what you realize is that this isn't worth the value of my time. But what you can do is you have a set of mentors behind you, and you farm that business out and recommend to somebody else who's willing to do that in the beginning of their consulting careers.
Yeah, those are really good points. And I think another thing to add on that is that return clients are, you know, that's the goal. And so one of the things I've been able to do is I've had some athletic training programs that have just asked me to review some documents, some accreditation documents. So I've just, charged them hourly for reviewing documents. And then once that is over, then now they're coming back and saying, okay, well, now we've gotten through that part. Would you now come help us build our curriculum for our master's program or whatever? And that's a nice compliment, and B, you know, you've got some return business if you do a good job on the first part.
Great point.
The other thing that that Adam was talking about, athletic trainers tend not to want to invest. We don't think we make enough money to invest in consultants. That is particularly true in some of our athletic training educational programs. If you talk to the program director, they're like, oh, well, we don't have any money to bring in a consultant. And what I've found is that a lot of my networking has been with the people that control the purse strings, deans, chairs, provosts, because they have the money. And if you convince them that your services can be valuable, then they will tell the program director that, you know what, why don't you bring in a consultant and here's the money to do it. And that's been much more successful than trying to go through the program director. And then the program director goes up and tries to ask for money, because they just, you know, athletic trainers, we tend not to ask for a whole lot. We can just do everything ourselves. It's kind of been the mentality. And so I've really tried to go kind of from the top down with some of my marketing and my networking.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to add something to that too, because historically when people are searching and shopping for consultants, they look at the lowest price, and that's not necessarily the best thing to do. And I'll tell you a really short, quick story. When Rob Rayberg and I had our consulting partnership, we went a couple of months at one point in time without any business from law firms, which is where we usually got them from. And we couldn't figure out what was wrong. And I give Rob credit. He spoke to his uncle, who's an attorney in Chicago, and he reviewed our documents. And what he came back and said was, you're not charging enough. And we were perplexed because we didn't have business. And here we are thinking, what do you mean we're not charging enough money? And what he basically said was, if you're a runner, you run marathons frequently, and you want to go out and buy a pair of running shoes, you're not going to spend $50. You're going to spend $250 on the best running shoe that's out there. And whatever it is you do, when that's your job and you're living, you're going to try to find the best. So if attorneys are searching for experts and they find that we charge the lowest, they might equate that with getting less quality service. And so we essentially raised our prices to make it appear as though we're more valuable and we're more expert than the next person. And I think there's really some strength to that. And the truth of the matter is, you are more valuable and you are worth something more. But because the inherent flavor in the profession is not to pay for these, we tend not to see individuals charging more money for their services. But you're going to get it. If you get an expert that comes in, it's worth every dime you pay for that person, because they're giving you a value that nobody else can.
Right. So obviously there's a lot of good information. I'm trying to take as many notes as I can. So one of the things that I actually this year, there's three different speaking engagements that I'm going to be at. I was at Trinity University speaking about how to promote athletic training. I'm going to be speaking in the Louisiana Athletic Trainers Association about tech tools. And then I'm going to be speaking at Memorial Hermann about social media for the sports medicine professional. And that's something for me that's fun. And, you know, like you're talking about networking opportunities. And, you know, I discussed it some with Adam about how those things can kind of help build, but also whether or not they fit into the LLC and the business and those kind of things. So if I want to continue to be asked to speak, you know, and someone pays for me to go to Florida or to, what I really want to do is try and get to Big Sky and do the podcast there. But, you know, if someone is saying, hey, come out here and do this, how do I build that? How do I grow that? And, you know, obviously the three that I'm doing this year or the multiple different podcast locations that I've done before, building that credibility, how do I continue to move and grow that aspect of the sports medicine broadcast?
The only thing I'll say before you guys chime in is just throw it out there. Tell people you want to do it, and then they'll ask you. Because these conferences are always looking for presenters. They're always having the same presenters year after year after year because their education committee knows a certain bandwidth of people. So to have new talent come into the pool, they're excited for it. So to all the points we've been talking about is just network and let people know that's what you want to do. And then most of the time they say, oh, great, we were looking for a spot. You're in. Like sometimes it's really that simple.
Yeah, I think the best thing you can do is own your presentations. When you go give those three, make them the best three presentations you've ever given in your life. So people are talking about it, and then there's your endorsements for others to say, you guys should need to bring Jeremy out to this meeting. No, nothing speaks more powerful than your action itself.
Yeah, I think both Adam and Jeff are spot on that aspect. But I think another thing is just letting people know that you're available for those things. One of the things that I've done in the past year is just show up at conferences. I paid on my own dime. And people are like, oh, we didn't know you were doing this and that you were doing consulting. And just showing up and talking with people and networking, that's going to help get the word out, because then, you know, then the word is going to spread that you are interested in doing that. So keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, Jeremy, you have a niche. You've already done that, right? You're doing something that others aren't doing. And one of the things that each of these meetings has in common is they want more attendance. If you can bring your service there and make it more public what's happening from a broadcast perspective, it's going to hopefully entice members within their region, the state or the district, for example, to maybe want to be at that conference in the future years. So you're essentially a marketing tool for others, but an informational marketing tool. And by setting up shop at these meetings and broadcasting live, I would think if I was maybe not so much a state meeting if it was too small, but from a district standpoint, I think that would be awesome to have you there and set up shop and do what you did in Orlando for Major League Soccer, for example, where you can bring those leaders in one by one and do some live broadcasts with them. That's a pretty powerful tool.
All right. So those of you listening, if you're in leadership or anything like that, you want me to come out to your meeting, or obviously I know some other people, you know, John Seco has helped me out, or, you know, I'm going to be in Vegas with lots of different people. So just get in touch with me. I would love to be able to come out there and, you know, maybe I want some of these meetings, bring my family along and have them help me out or those kind of things too. So I'd like to come out and meet you in person. So put me in contact with, or, you know, tell the powers that be at your meetings about this. And then I'll continue to work on that reaching out as well. So cool. All right. So let's get back to consulting. What else can you guys tell me about becoming a consultant, or maybe the life of the consultant, or the negative aspects of being a consultant for athletic training?
Well, I'll approach it from the full-time standpoint, and Jeff can talk about it, since he does, you know, he's got a real job and then does consulting on the side. I think one of the things that's been the hardest for me to adjust to is that I don't necessarily have to work 8 to 5. I've always been in a role where I've been at my desk at 7:30 in the morning and I'm there till 5, and I've just always been in that. In the last several years, I've been in that role. And because I work for myself, I can work when and where I want. And there's sometimes there's a lot of things to do, and sometimes you you know, you're very, very busy, and other times you're not as busy. And so I'm learning. It only took me a lot of years to learn how to have a little bit of work-life balance. And maybe it's not balance. Maybe it's more work-life blend. Because I may be, out on the golf course and get an email and then go ahead and correspond that way and set up a call or something like that. So I'm technically, I'm still working, but I don't have to sit at my desk. I think the other thing that is different from having a full-time job is that I don't get a paycheck every 2 weeks. And that takes some discipline. It takes some getting used to. I've always been good at selling an idea or a concept, but now I'm having to sell myself and my services. And that's difficult. It's just something I've never had to do really before. So I think those are some of the difficult things. You don't have a paycheck every 2 weeks. And so you have to take them when you can get them. But it's the lifestyle is great. You have to just keep making sure that you've got more potential jobs in the pipeline. And as you're working on one job, you can't forget about continuing to market yourself for potential future jobs, because you don't want to wait till you're done with that one job and then all of a sudden be sitting there going, well, okay, now I don't have anything to do and I have no income. So you have to kind of keep that pipeline full of potential contacts.
I think what Mickey's point about blending is really critical. There's no such thing as a balance anymore. It's not possible to balance because every day is going to run a different circuit of where you are. But I think the really important thing to consider is professional consulting is not a hobby. You have to be accountable. And particularly in the area that I work in with risk management, with attorneys and malpractice cases, these are people's lives. And you have to be on your A game and you have to do your homework. And if you've never been through a deposition, you don't understand exactly what I'm talking about, because you will be held accountable to everything you say and everything you put in writing. So the stakes are different depending on the type of consulting you're doing. Regardless of that, though, people are paying you to be a profession or a professional. And there's a reason they're paying you for your services. And so you have to take it seriously on every single individual consulting opportunity that you have, not just so you can look for the next opportunity, but because that's your obligation and that's what you're held accountable to stand behind.
So we actually, I asked this question of Adam yesterday, and he mentioned the same thing, being accountable for the information when you're being paid for a service. So if on this sports medicine broadcast I say something that is incorrect, what does that look like for me as far as being accountable? Again, getting some of that free consulting here from Dr. Jeff Conan.
Oh, well, I mean, everybody's human and we will make mistakes and we may not say things that are accurate all the time. I think the key is that that's not your MO. It's not a trend where you're constantly talking or writing and you have inaccuracies and you're incompetent. If I don't know something, I'm going to say it. I don't know that, or I'm going to look it up. There have been many times being questioned by attorneys where they'll ask me a question about a case and I have 2 feet high stack of documents from the case. I don't remember everything in there. And I will take my time and say, I'm going to need a minute to go back and find where this is in the notes and I can answer your question. What people really want to do is if you're going to be held accountable, they want to know the facts. And if you don't know the facts, you look them up or you say you don't know them. Now, if you don't know them enough times, you have to go back and self-reflect and ask if you truly have an expertise or not, and you should be getting paid to consult with other people. But we're all human and we will all make mistakes and things change on a regular basis, whether it be CADI guidelines or state practice acts. And so that's your job as an expert, is to keep up with those changes. And it's not always easy. And trust me, when you're at that point, at the top of your game, as a leader position, others are always trying to find the mistakes that you make and shoot you down and correct you when you say something that's not completely accurate.
I can just see Brandy Curry. She was listening live, doing like a fist bump when you said self-reflection. I can just see her. She's excited. So Scott Muller joining in live. Stephanie Wise jumping in also. Daria Aller, all of those checking in live on the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/Facebook. So we're going to continue discussing consulting as an AT. Adam, you kind of met with Dr. Conan, and you guys have been talking about mentoring. But both Dr. Conan and Dr. Cuppet are part of the Innovate AT private group. So let's discuss the mentorship and growing as a professional, and Adam, kind of how you're facilitating that within Innovate AT, and then the value that you're getting from that as well.
No, that's a good question. I mean, everyone listening who's an athletic trainer, and everyone in our profession has had the exact same journey from the day one of starting their profession. And that is, we have the traditional term is, I had a mentor who taught me how to tape an ankle. I had a mentor who told me where to go to grad school. I had a mentor who helped me get a job. And in the true sense of the word, that really isn't mentorship. That's just providing a little bit of guidance and maybe an opportunity for them to move their career forward. So back to what I talked about earlier, that our profession is kind of missing this true personal development and individual success about how do I become kind of better than I am now. So within the private group that we have, we're having a much deeper, richer conversation. And unfortunately, to Jeff's point earlier about what social media is creating within, you know, fake news, and we call them screen snipers, where people think they're an expert, or they like to stand behind their screen and just kind of attack people, and they really aren't doing anything. We were forced to create a much more comprehensive in-person conversation that allows experts to provide expertise to people that are really hungry for that type of information. So then from there, we're building out a mentorship program where if someone really wants to grow as an individual, we have experience athletic trainers in all different aspects of life and the profession to provide that guidance. And to what both Mickey and Jeff said earlier, we're not telling them what to do. That isn't mentorship. We're saying, here is a way to look at it. Here's some things that I've challenged myself with in the past. Here's some of the expertise of where CADI guidelines are going. Here's some of the risks within the legality of the conversation and the situation. Now, what's best for you, and how are you going to do it? Or to how Brandy is addressing, what is your personal passion? What do you want to do? Because if our profession says, well, we have to work in the traditional model, and someone says, well, I don't want to work in the traditional model, there's not a path laid out for that. So our mentorship program is just, what do you want to do as an individual? And we'll help you get there. But at the end of the day, the individual has to be accountable. They have to make the decisions to do it. And they have to put one foot in front of the other. And in order to do that, we have to have both sides of the athletic training paradigm. We have to have the experienced athletic trainers that can provide that guidance. And then we have to have the younger, hungry athletic trainers that want to take a new path. So, like, I mean, I say it all the time. This is Innovate AT is not about Adam. I'm really not a consultant. I kind of drive this new way of thinking, and then I'm bringing in all these experts or individuals that want to see the profession evolve and grow. And then we're a like-minded group of people that are talking about how to take it to the next level. So hopefully that answered your question about the private group, because the public group, we can't have that conversation because there's just too many people that aren't engaged. They just want what we call free stuff. They want to look like they're important, but they're really not doing anything to challenge themselves. Within that private group, everyone is challenging themselves. Everyone is saying, you know what, I want to do something better, not just for myself, but for my family, my friends, and the profession as a whole. And how can we do it as a unit, as a collective group?
So, Jeremy, you know, too many people look at the NATA as some abstract planet out there. You know, why isn't it spinning this way? Why isn't it orbiting at a different rate? NATA is us. And NATA and the strategic partners are us. But we can only do so much as a collective whole. And it's none of the strategic partners' responsibility to independently do what we do and change our own personal lives. And when I met with Adam, I requested the meeting because I not only liked what I was hearing come out of what he was doing, but he was actually doing it in a positive way and trying to give others the tools to succeed independently, not be reliant upon a membership organization to hand you tools to say, here's how you do it. You can only do so much as a national organization. And that's where Adam comes in and his leadership team and everybody. I agree 100% with what he just said. The people that are joining because they want to, and they want to have some kind of change, and they want to learn the tools and then use those tools on their own in their own given world, whether it be their professional or their personal lives or both.
The mentor-mentee relationship is such a win-win for both parties. And we do a good job of this in our colleges and universities, where typically students have faculty mentors, students have preceptors that are mentors, and then these students then graduate, they become, you know, credentialed athletic trainers, they go out and then they're at a high school and they're by themselves and they're isolated. And so I love some of the things that Adam is doing with Innovate AT and just providing opportunities for potential mentor-mentee relationships. And I think so many times younger ATs, younger professionals don't want, they say, oh, well, you're so busy. You know, you're so busy, I don't want to bother you. It is not a bother. It's the relationship is just as satisfying for the mentor as it is for the mentee. And so please seek out people that have experience. We want to share, as Jeff said earlier, both the things we've done well and then the things we didn't do so well. Let us help you navigate some of the landmines of the profession. And this isn't a responsibility for the national organization, the membership organization. It's a responsibility of all of us collectively, both seasoned athletic trainers and new athletic trainers. You know, so seasoned athletic trainers need to reach out and help, and the younger athletic trainers, find yourself a mentor. It will be such, or multiple mentors. It will be such a positive experience for you.
And I'm going to tell you that I'm not a big fan of this term young professionals. It's discriminatory against people like Nikki and I. But the truth of the matter is, you don't have to find an older person as a mentor. I oftentimes lean back on former students of mine now who are in a different setting that I'm no longer in and say, Tom, hey, what are you doing there now? How are you treating this? And what are the issues that you see in your environment? You never know it all. And so I don't think that the mentor always has to be someone who's older or has more years of experience than you do. But again, as I said from the very beginning, somebody who has some sense of expertise given the setting and environment they're in and their background and skill set that they bring to the table.
Yeah, one other thing I want to address through like my personal research, just talking with a bunch of athletic trainers, the setting that has the most organized mentorship is actually the industrial setting. And I think that is because the industrial setting follows a really solid business model where it's not, you know, if we look at the coaching model or the athletics model, it's a business model that is generated on revenue. So the individual athletic trainer is a revenue stream, and it may not be they're bringing in money, but they're focused on cost savings with employee health. So there are multiple companies within the industrial space really focus on the mentorship model, where an athletic trainer has two or three levels above them that they get to talk to and talk about performance and how can they increase their performance and rewards. And then they start to mentor the younger athletic trainers that have a job within that industrial setting. So like I am always looking at what can we follow and duplicate and model the efforts that already exist. I'm not just making up this idea about a mentorship. I'm looking at the industrial setting saying, well, if it's working over there, what are you guys incorporating? What type of learning, what type of educational tools, and let's just bring it over to Innovate AT so then the secondary schools can have the similar access, collegiate setting can have the same access. So I think if someone is at a secondary school and they're looking for mentorship, look for programs within your community that work. Go out and network outside of the athletic setting. Go to just the chamber event and go meet new people that work even within like a Jiffy Lube. Like these big companies that are out there really help with individual development because they want them to go up the ladder within their corporate structure. And athletic training can follow some of that. We just haven't ever looked at athletic training as a business. It's always just been a service. And that's not going to grow us at all.
And that's a really good segue into our professional education. We've done a really good job enhancing our competencies from a clinical aspect. I don't think we've done as good of a job in preparing our ATs from the business perspective. And until we do that, until we take a real serious look at integrating, for example, curricular content on true value and true business models and things like that, we won't have to be as reliant upon expert consultants to tell us how to make more money and work less hours. We all have that ability to do it. We're just not taught formally how, or by people who have done it to teach you formally how to do it. You can't just put it in a textbook, put it up on a slide, and read it to a student and give them an exam question. It really has to be practical learning opportunities from those that have been there and done that. And that's something that we as a profession really need to take a hard look at for the future viability of where we go as athletic trainers.
One quick thing to Jeff's point, if you ask anyone who has their MBA, they will always tell you the most impressive teachers they had during their MBA program were the business owners that came in and taught a specific class or just specific topic, other than just a professor that was talking about business concepts. Everyone that gets an MBA talks about that, that it's always real life experience has much more weight on the learning experience than someone who just is teaching from a book.
All right, so my coworker is retiring this year. So at the end of this year, I'll be hiring somebody new. I am looking for somebody young that will be able to grow with me. And so I will be in that mentorship role. And again, it's not quite consulting like we're talking about, but a big part of that, what we have been talking about as consulting, is networking, developing other athletic trainers, and then, you know, them being able to talk about it. And so as I look for a athletic trainer who will be able to kind of grow with me and I can mentor, what are some of the things that I really need to do as an athletic trainer, as a mentor, as a, you know, 15 years in the profession, athletic trainer, to help our program grow here at Pasadena High School and to help that athletic trainer grow to their fullest potential?
For $400 an hour, I will help you recruit the right person.
Got it. Got to get another sponsorship first.
I think, you know, all kidding aside, I think listening, if you listen to the person, you know, sometimes it's just being a sounding board. And then as they're asking, and having them not be afraid to ask you questions, and then providing them with thought-provoking questions back, not necessarily answers, but helping them think through the process. If, you know, maybe it's a diagnosis, maybe, you know, maybe it's a business process, but listen, because I think so many people in a mentorship role just want to talk. And so I think listening to what their goals are, asking them what their goals are, taking an interest in what their goals are professionally, and helping them, helping them sort through some of those.
Jeremy, I think the interview is a facade. The person you're going to hire has been living a life or being a student or working a career for many years. And there can be red flags in the interview that tell you this is not the right person, but I wouldn't solely rely on a strong interview, but I would weigh heavily on individuals that have crossed paths with that person in the past and find out as much as you can about them. This is the reason why in other professions, particularly allied health, PT, OT, PA, things like that, students are offered their first career jobs on internships because they're doing essentially 12-week or 16-week interviews. And there's no questions that you need to ask that would be accomplished in a one-hour interview. You can see the person's work ethic. You can see their interpersonal skills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I really rely heavily on other people that know those people to tell me what they can about them. And then I do the best that I can to integrate that, what I've learned, into what I'm really looking for before you would make a hire.
Yeah, Jeremy, the one thing I'll say is, and I won't look at the interview process. I'll kind of look at, once you have hired the best candidate, is you have to let them fail. And in order to let them fail, you have to give them the opportunity to follow what they feel is right. And then if they follow that and it didn't work out appropriately or correctly and they fail, they're actually going to be better. And that was to both of the points we talked about earlier, that sometimes failure creates the most, you know, success opportunities. And you have to let them come in with a new mindset and a new way of thinking. I mean, all of us have been in the profession long enough that we hear stories all the time of senior athletic trainers have younger staffs and they're not on the same page and we're just doing it the old way. And I want to initiate a new process. That if you really want to have growth within a mentorship, you have to allow the mentee to provide guidance to grow, not just individually, but the entire program to the next level. Because we all know technology is different. The way, you know, younger generations are thinking and acting is different. They're going to be more connected as to maybe delivering a better level of healthcare because they have a stronger connection with just younger athletes in today's athletic world. Yeah. So I think sometimes it really looks at the mentor as, what do I need to do more than what does the mentee need to do?
All right. Lots of great wisdom, opportunity to grow as an athletic trainer here. Again, going from experience, but people who are shaping the future with their experience, and Dr. Cuppett helping build programs, Dr. Conan, again, helping people stay out of trouble with a lot of the legal risk consultant stuff. And then Adam helping innovate AT, there's a lot of opportunity for growth and a lot of opportunity for me personally. And that's one of the things, like both of you said, that I look forward to most is some of the new skills and new ways of thinking of the brand new athletic trainers are different from what I was taught and from what I'm used to. And so I look forward to embracing that and bringing that in and just seeing what they know, what they can do, what they can show me is, and then, you know, how we can work together. So that's something I'm really excited about in the change. Obviously losing somebody I've been working with for 12 years is scary. It's a little difficult, but I'm, you know, ready to embrace that change there. As we're wrapping it up, I'm going to have one more question and then we're going to ask for your contact information. So with all the experiences that you have, we'll start with Dr. Cuppett. What do you want your legacy to be?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I think I want my legacy to be that I'm passionate about athletic training. I'm passionate about the profession. And during my time in this profession, that I did everything in my power to help move the profession forward.
You know, I think for me, it's that I enjoyed what I do. I enjoyed the relationships that I made. And at the end of the day, those relationships are more valuable and mean more than what we do on a daily basis relative to our vocation.
Yeah, I mean, ditto to everything they said. And then just one other additional piece that's just coming to mind as you asked the question is that I was able to create, I don't want to say change in a negative sense, but I was able to evolve the profession based on standards, based on the time that we're in. Because I kind of look at athletic training as still using a rotary phone. I don't think we're really moving into the 21st century. I think, yeah, there's new modalities we're doing and we're moving into new settings, but it's still the same package with different wrapping paper. So I'm really focused on how do we evolve, and as long as we can evolve, then I can sleep at night. I can put my head on my pillow and say I did everything I could for the entire profession to move into, you know, the new frontier.
Awesome. So the call to action for this podcast is to join the email list. Again, I've sending out updates about our AT scavenger hunt because it's National Athletic Training Month. So this week we are doing, if you search hashtag SAT scavenger hunt 2019 on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, then we're putting out one mission per day. So again, that's here in 2019. We did something similar in 2018 to where, you know, lots of different schools and their student programs were doing activities. So again, I send those out via email or special deals, discounts, ways to save some money, ways to improve, sometimes some lessons that I've learned from all these great experts. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/email is the way to join the email list. But this one is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/consultant, where you can get a hold of Dr. Mickey Cuppett, Dr. Jeff Conan, or Mr. Adam Halpern. So Dr. Cuppett, somebody wants to reach out to you directly, what's going to be the best way to do that?
They can email me at mickeycuppettconsulting.com. It's Mickey with an I, M-I-C-K-I, C-U-P-P-E-T-T, consulting.com.
All right, so Mickey Cuppett Consulting, or Mickey at mickeycuppettconsulting.com. Best way to reach out there, or you can just check out Mickey Cuppett Consulting and then the contact her and that kind of stuff there. All right, Dr. Conan.
Dr. Jeff Conan. @gmail.com.
So Dr. Jeff, K-O-N-I-N @gmail.com. And then Adam at innovateat.com. And again, like he said on previous podcasts, he's on various social medias as well. So you can find Innovate AT, and Adam is the kind of the boss behind all that. So Adam, anything different?
No, I mean, I don't want to call myself a boss. I would say founder.
Okay. Whatever term you want to put there is okay. All right. And then Frio Hydration does a great job. Actually, they're the ones that are kind of running the scavenger hunt this year. And so they do a great job supporting athletic trainers, built by and for athletic trainers. Dragonfly Max is going to be hosting the podcast lounge. Hoist Hydration, you can use the code DSMB to save some and get some free sometimes. And then Myotech is the newest sponsor of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And we're continually adding some there so that we can continue to add value and promote and improve our profession as athletic trainers. So for Dr. Mickey Cuppett, for Dr. Jeff Conan, for Adam Halpern and Jeremy Jackson, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/consultant. And that is a wrap. Thanks.